Session number 25574, Rule 8.
Sorry, you were telling us about this building.
Yes, I can recall that the main building, the remains of it, but all that remained was some highly damaged or very greatly damaged steelwork, which I understand still stands in the Peace Park in Hiroshima. But as far as the residential area was concerned, there was nothing left.
Because what the bomb didn't destroy,
the fire did, because
we have to remember that the
house in there wasn't like this.
They were wooden and bamboo.
And the mats on the floor were tatamis. They were made of
a bamboo. In fact, everything was flammable. The doors,
the internal doors, were a very light timber, and they had paper on the a door like that one over there would have sort of paper on the paint. Everything was flammable, and once the fire started, it was a self-generating. It had a self-generating effect, I believe. I was not there, but I saw the aftermath of it.
What went through your mind seeing the destruction of Hiroshima?
Bad luck, mate. I'm sorry, I was a young soldier, and I seen the devastation that these people had done elsewhere, and I must say I wasn't too fussed about it.
What other sights were you to see of Hiroshima?
I was there on a number of occasions on working. I think once you'd seen it, you'd seen it. That was it, end of story. Although it was quite surprising how they managed in the 12 months or so I was in Japan to get things back to normal. Somehow they got the electricity generating, and they were repairing the electric wiring, because it's 110 volt there rather than 240. Yes, they were starting to rebuild even in that time. Yes, the tram started to run in some sort of a fashion. The railway must have escaped widespread destruction, I think, because the trains were running reasonably reliably, because there was quite a good service between Kure and Hiroshima. And one occasion I travelled by train to Tokyo, and that was a bit later on, but that was functioning quite well.
Mm. What are the people in Hiroshima? How are they? How are they coping?
Not particularly well, because you don't have a roof over your head, and you don't have anything to eat, and a lot of your family or relations have been killed or badly wounded. You don't cope too well. That city was a very morbid place, I just have to say. There was not much humour there, I can assure you. I'm talking about the Japanese. Well, there was nothing to occupy there. So, matter of fact, that might be one of the reasons that the Australians were given, or the British Commonwealth force were given Kure and Hiroshima to occupy, because there wasn't much left. I suppose I'm being a bit cynical, but I believe that there's an element of truth in that. So,
did you have any? I mean, I understand you mentioned, "Oh, bad luck, mate. You did it to us," that sort of thing. But did you have any understanding, or did you have any opinion about the futility of war at the time? The point of it all at the time?
No. The point of it all was to beat the bloody Japanese. That was all that was in my mind. I was young, and we had but one objective in view, was to defeat the Japanese. Full stop.
Mm.
No, I didn't think about the futility of it. It's a different matter now. But at the time, no. A job that had to be done, John, and we did it.
So what was your duty to be in Hiroshima?
Well, I didn't have very much to do there at all, because and I can't tell you exactly why we went there. It was to do with some Australian troops on a train, and they had been causing some or committing some crime on a train, and I wasn't involved. I didn't involve myself in any inquiries that, and I'm speaking generally now, I had 12 months with the Special Investigation Branch, and I only involved myself in investigations involving Japanese. I wasn't a member of the SI Special Investigation Branch, I was an interpreter. Although I actually found myself becoming involved, one couldn't help but this was only with Japanese. I had nothing to do with investigations with Australian troops. I think very wisely too.
Why?
Well, because I wasn't a member of the Special Investigation Branch. I was a member of, I think it was called SISDIC, all right? No, ATIS was on my pass, which took me anywhere. My ID card or ID pass. So I can't tell you exactly why we went to Hiroshima on that occasion. Ken Rooney handled the matter. I was the driver. So we went back to Hiroshima, and I moved into the quarters we had, which were quite pleasant, I might add.
Where were they?
They were in some buildings which had escaped the bombing. They were part of the naval, Japanese naval headquarters, and they were quite pleasant quarters. We had a couple of rooms each. A couple of rooms between the. Must have been four or five of us, and a house girl to come in and do the cleaning and do the washing, and generally look after us. It was quite a pleasant existence after what we'd had experienced in the past. And of course I had a jeep at my disposal, which was very handy, thank you very much.
Mentioning you were staying in Kure, what were some of the other duties that you were involved with?
Well, my total duties were with the Special Investigation Branch.
What were some of the things that you were to investigate?
Oh, I hasten to add that the Special Investigation Branch isn't the military police at all. It's totally different. The military police were like the British Red Caps. The Special Investigation Branch is more detective work. What did we investigate? We investigated large-scale black marketing by Australian troops, which of course involved Japanese, because if there was black marketing, there had to be someone to purchase.
Tell us about that.
What is there to tell? There was...
What sort of things were they trading?
Sugars. Sugar, for example. And I'm talking truckloads of sugar. Not standing on the corner selling a packet of cigarettes or chocolate, something like that. This was large scale.
What were the things that were on main demand?
Chocolates, sugar, clothing. What else? Well, they come to mind. Food, meat, anything. Yes, meat, that sort of thing. Mm. One particular case, I might add, we never solved it, involved truckloads of sugar. And Ken Rooney and I, we could never get a hold on, never get a handle on it properly. And we even had a 168 AGT, which is a transport unit, because we reasoned that if there was a truck involved, it would have been from the AGT. We had a mass parade of the all the drivers, and we had a Japanese girl, I forget her name now, she was mixed up in this, and she walked along with her looking at these fellas. I think she was a bloody good actress, this girl. And she never batted an eyelid. If she did go past the fellow involved, she never batted an eyelid. But years later, I found out why we never got a finger on it.
Why?
For the simple reason, I've got to be very careful here, that the central figure in this black marketing was a top man in a unit or organisation that had access to large quantities of foodstuffs such as sugar. I might add, we never, ever, ever suspected that such a high-ranking person would be involved. I can tell you, changing the subject, another interesting story. Mm-hmm. And I call this the Dorothy Drain story. I'll sort of set the scene.
Okay.
When the first lot of troops arrived there, and the second lot of troops, a lot of these fellows were pretty hardened soldiers, and they'd been in the jungles and they'd been to the Middle East and so on. And the women in the islands were fairly black, and with due respect, most of them not particularly attractive. But when they got to Japan, they saw these slant-eyed women with yellow skins, and they didn't look too appealing. But after a week, the eyes weren't quite so slanty, and they weren't quite so brown, and the hair wasn't quite so black. And after 2 weeks, the yellow skin had been pretty close to white. And these were, they were young fellas, and they were pretty fit. And needless to say, the Japanese, being fairly entrepreneurial, accommodated them, and they set up brothels and so on. And these brothels actually multiplied. And as a result, I've got to be fair and say the VD rate did go up. Anyhow, who should arrive in Japan as a reporter from the Women's Weekly, which is still going, I believe, although it's published monthly now, was that Dorothy Drain, whom I met. She subsequently became the editor of Women's Weekly, but she published a story in the Women's Weekly which had an element of truth in it, but my God, it was magnified out of all proportion. And this really was quite bad publicity, because here were wives at home and sweethearts at home in Australia, and they're reading this about how the fellas were drunk all the time and they were smoking their heads off and they were living in the brothels and so on. I repeat, there was an element of truth in it, but this was absolutely blown up out of all proportion. So what happened was, the next thing I knew, the commanding officer, and I forget his name, I never knew it really, of all the Australian occupation, and it wasn't Red Robbie, it was a fellow under him, decided that he would go out and have a look for himself. So an appointment is made for one evening, and the big chief, who was only a little man, and there's Jimmy Henderson, who was a major, and he was the DAPM, the Assistant Provost Marshal. He was in charge of security and the SIB and the military police and so on. And Ken Rooney, the warrant officer in charge of the Special Investigation Branch, and myself. And we get into the staff car this evening with a driver, a chauffeur, and we set off to have a look around, to show the big chief around. Well, why he persisted, I don't know. It was the worst night, weather-wise, that I had ever experienced in Japan. There were fences blown over, there were roofs off building, it was shocking. And so we drove around and he said, well, show me the where these brothels are. So I showed him where they were, because it was my job to know. And there was not much activity there, I can assure you. So we're driving round. And I remember that there was a no fraternisation order on at the time. And we came across one poor inoffensive Australian soldier out with a Japanese girl, and they're huddled up in the corner. And the CO says, stop the car. He said, Sergeant, take that man's name and regimental number and have him disciplined. So I said, yes, sir, righto. So I went over and I said, you poor bastard, I've only got the CO in there and the provost marshal and the chief of the special investigation. Brad, you better give me your name and number and regiment, which he did. And I said, it'd be a good idea to keep off the streets, I think, with your friend there. And that was the end of the matter. I did nothing about it, because on the basis I thought, well, I don't think anybody's ever going to check up whether the man was disciplined. I just laughed about it. Anyway, what happened then was that the car was stopped, and CO said, well, I haven't seen very much activity, but he said, the figures are such that we've got a problem. So he said, Henderson, fix it. Just get it fixed. So Henderson turns to Rooney and he says, well, Rooney, you fix it. And Rooney looked at me and he said, you. I thought this was quite humorous. Here I'm the sergeant and I've got to fix it. So I said, well, all right. I don't quite know what to do, but would you give me a few days and I'll think about it and I'll tell you what we'll do. Yes, righto, that's fine, Fred. Good, thanks very much. This is hard to believe, isn't it? But it's true. Anyhow, I thought about it. And I forget whether I went to Jimmy Henderson, the major, or to Rooney, or both of them. And I said, well, I've thought about what we're going to do. They said, what are you going to do? I said, well, it's fairly elementary. I'm going to go around and I'm going to have all the small brothels closed. There's half the problem. I'll just close them. And then there's about three or four large ones which are very well run and managed. And we'll have those kept open. And I'll have the girls examined regularly by medical people. And I said, solve the problem. So Henderson said to me, you can't do that. I said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to do it. You told me to fix the problem. Here's a sergeant talking to this major. He said, you can't do it. I said, well, I'm going to do it. You just bloody watch me. And there was no answer to that. I'd been told to fix it, not told them what I was going to do. Anyway, the next day I took myself down to Japanese chief of police, I should say, and sat him down and told him what I wanted him to do. And he nodded his head and said, yes, what are the ones you want left open? And I told him, he said, right. And that was end of story. It was done. And it solved the problem. But I still think it's quite remarkable. He's a sergeant interpreter telling the Japanese chief of police. Order the Japanese chief of police. Anyway, I repeat that it solved the problem. The VD rate went down because these girls were examined by doctors. Oh, I won't tell you about that, but anyway, that's almost the end of the story, but it's not quite. Because when it came time for me to go home to Australia, I'd said goodbye to one and all, but I hadn't gone to see the chief of police, which was probably an oversight on my part. But I was on board either the Canimbla or the Manura to come home, and I'm called over the loudspeaker, so I went, and they said, you're wanted by the Special Investigation Branch. I said, oh, dear me. So here's Rooney. I said, what's going on here? He said, I want you. I said, Ken, I'm going home. He said, yes, I know, but I want you. You're wanted for interrogation. I said, oh, all right. Can you imagine this? I'm taking off the ship that I'm going home on. By Rooney, my mate. And so we drove, and the Japanese chief of police had got all of his top brass, and there was Ken Rooney and I and a couple of others, and it was the greatest feast I've ever seen in my life in Japan. And there was sake laid on and goodness knows what. And the chief of police made a speech thanking me for all my help and goodness knows what. So they poured me onto the ship and I came home. So that's the end of that story.
In your time in Japan, obviously there was this American occupation, the democratization of Japan.
Mm.
What was your impression of the whole scenario, how that was developing? We had women having equal rights, the politics was changed, the role of the emperor, MacArthur's role in Japan?
I wasn't involved in that at all.
But what were your impressions?
I didn't have any impressions. Now, if you spoke to some other interpreters there, they could talk to you about it. They were probably with field security and so on. For example, they were sent out into these brothels, these interpreters, and they had to speak to the girls and say, you know that General MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, is in charge of this country now, and he's running this country, and he says that you are free, that you don't have to stay in your bond and in your bondage, and you're free to go, you can walk out. Hee-hee-hee, the girls would say, hee-hee-hee, don't we like it here? We like what we're doing. Thank you very much. We've never heard of MacArthur. I don't know. I wasn't involved in that, but others were.
But in the day-to-day life, in the day-to-day sights that you were to see, how was Japan developing, would you say?
Well, they were getting their act together as far... I'm talking about the man in the street and the business people and so on. They were just going about their business, trying to get their lives together, and they weren't doing too bad. They weren't doing it too badly. They were getting things going again. Mm. Mm.
You mentioned, obviously, the situation with the ladies in the brothel not knowing MacArthur, but what was MacArthur's general position? How was that seen?
I don't know.
How did you see MacArthur in your experience in Japan?
I had nothing to do with him. I didn't know he existed, really. All I knew of MacArthur was that he'd come to Australia and I shall return, and he returned and he had a photographic records of his return, which was fairly stage-managed and so on.
Was there still the same sort of respect for the emperor that you envisaged from the average person?
Yes. Oh, yes. My word, ten no haka. Yes. Oh, yes. Very much so. Mm. They were very, very devoted to their emperor. I think your question is, notwithstanding the fact that they had been defeated in the war. Because my own view is, I don't know that they blamed the emperor personally for the war. It was Tojo and the others that were the warmongers.
Did you ever see or sense the sort of rebuilding of Japan by the Allies?
No. No, as I said, I had this job to do, and it was a full-time job with Rooney and Company, and that was my my occupation. There could very well have been other interpreters involved in those sorts of activities, but I was not involved in them.
How did you find your time in Japan then?
In what sense?
You'd gone to Japan, you didn't really want to go to Japan. How had you found it?
Oh, I didn't want to go, but I went, because I'd done a deal with Usher Tinkler, and I went, and I enjoyed being there, I think. Yes, I enjoyed being there. I had a very, very interesting life there with the Special Investigation Branch. I made some good mates outside of the what I was doing, friends at the radio station, WLKS, and when we had some time off, we used to go and have a picnic, or there wasn't very much else to do there.